This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell. This is the first of a two-part episode featuring Dr. John Marsliff, an emeritus professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington. In his extensive academic and research experiences, his work has primarily focused on the dynamics of avian species, namely pinyon jays, various corvids, and birds of prey. In the first part of our interview, we will discuss his background, his studies on urban ecology, and social dynamics observed in pinyon jays.
John, thank you so much for joining me today.
You bet, Ben. My pleasure.
So your academic background extends across multiple states, and your research extends across multiple states. But you started with your bachelor's in University of Montana. Could you tell me a little bit about what got you interested in wildlife biology, and maybe what got you in the direction of studying bird ecology?
Yeah, my interest in wildlife really started as a high school student. I had two really great high school teachers, one that would take us backpacking in Colorado and expose us to the mountains. This was from eastern Kansas, and one who would take us out all over the state of Kansas collecting basically any kind of animal that needed to be surveyed and assessed and even brought back to the museum at the university there. And I went to school at the University of Montana, and that's where I really got turned on to birds more specifically. I'd always been interested in birds or mammals, whatever. And there was a new professor there, Dick Hutto, who was an ornithologist. And as a young guy from California, he had a lot of enthusiasm and got us out looking at birds and counting birds and got me into an internship with Forest Service to survey birds. And that really stoked my interest in the scientific investigation of bird populations and individuals.
Nice. Yeah, Dr. Hutto actually appeared on an episode of this program a few months ago. Yeah, he was very...
Awesome.
Very enthusiastic. It was great talking with him.
Yeah, great.
A lot of your research has involved urban ecology studies, long-running urban ecology studies. And I'm curious, most of the time when we think about like avian research, picturing being out in kind of natural spaces, what does bird surveying in an urbanized landscape look like?
Yeah, it's kind of like a battle, basically. You've got not only trying to see and hear the birds with a lot of noise and other activity, but you have a lot of privacy issues around land ownership, with some people, you know, being glad to invite you in and, you know, have breakfast at their house and watch the birds at their house, and others that are like, no, stay the heck out of here. We don't want anybody looking around what's going on here. I remember one case, a couple of cases in particular. One of the students working for me was surveying birds in Seattle, and the police stopped him and put him out over the hood of the car and, you know, searched him for, you know, they knew he was doing something wrong, but of course he was just surveying birds, but he had binoculars and a recorder and writing stuff down, and it all looks quite suspicious, but it's really not. And then another time, where I was walking around looking at the response of crows and wearing a crazy mask. And before I got home, the school where my kids were at school in grade school had been locked down because of this strange person walking around. One of the neighbors had called my wife. And before I even got all the way back around the route, the police were there waiting. And my wife was there like, what's going on? And it was quite a scene. But that's the kind of thing you run into in urban areas that you don't necessarily run into in more wildland areas.
So you released a book covering, you know, different relationships between land use and avian diversity. And to me, what you observed is a little bit, it kind of breaks certain expectations that people might have about urbanization and wildlife. So what is the relationship between suburban development and bird diversity that you observed?
Yeah, what we observed, and this was in Western Washington, so a relatively newly settled region of the United States for sure. What we observed there was that if you start surveying birds in the wildland, forested areas and the Cascades, and move towards the ocean and end up basically in Seattle, In downtown Seattle, of course, bird diversity is fairly low. It's not as low as you would think. There's a lot of different species from gulls and other water birds that are using that coastal interface, and lots of forest birds and birds that are pretty well adapted to living with people that are in right in the core of the city. It's still a fairly green city relative to other places. But what we found was that not so surprising that lower diversity in the heart of the city, we found the highest diversity not in the forest, but instead kind of in between, in areas that were settled as suburbs. Some of those maybe were 30 or 40 years old. Others were brand new, just being created. And as we mix up the land cover there from just pure, wet coniferous forest that's typical there to a mixture of open areas and forested areas and some areas with high intensity of human use, others pretty low intensity, you get a high diversity of birds. And these include a mix of birds that are urban adapted, things like pigeons that might occur there, to birds that are exploiting human activity, things like chickadees that readily come into bird feeders and like more open deciduous forest, for example, some of the black-capped chickadee in particular there, and other species that are more avoiders of development, really strict coniferous forest species. Some of those still hang on. So you get things like red-breasted nuthatches and chestnut-backed chickadees there in the suburbs that you would find in maybe greater abundance further away from development, but still that mix of some kind of avoiders, some exploiters, some that really adapt to human activity, all in the suburbs. So diversity peak there. We'd always thought, well, the more development there is, the fewer birds there are going to be, or fewer biodiversity there's going to be, and that's true for mammals for sure, but not so for birds, and definitely not so for plants because we bring in so many other plants. So this increased biodiversity in lightly settled parts of the world is a good message, I think, to understand and try to see what it means in terms of overall diversity of a region.
Absolutely. Yeah. How can people lean into that that pattern of elevated biodiversity and, with their own maybe their own little slot in urban development, promote higher diversity of both avian species as well as mammals and plants?
Yeah, I mean, first thing is to understand that we're just part of this community, right? We're not excluding everything from it, but we should learn how to live with it. I think it was one of the best quotes from Aldo Leopold's work to me is that we view the environment we're in as a community rather than a commodity, even though we buy and sell land. And some people view it as simply a commodity. If you start seeing it as a whole community, you have a different level of respect and love for it, basically. So understanding that first, and then some of the things that we can do to live easier on the land, make the ability of some of those species that tend to avoid humans be able to survive in the patches that still remain there, are basically to try to make your piece of that habitat as diverse as possible. So, and as natural as possible, I would say. So not a turf lawn. That's kind of the worst thing we can do for diversity in these areas. So if you can increase the diversity of your lawn, simple things like just not mowing it can have a big effect, or actually going in and replanting with shrubs or a combination of shrubs and native grasses, for example, especially here in the Yellowstone region, providing some natural grass cover is good for the species that require that, that might otherwise, steer away from our developments. Increasing the food availability and shelter that's available there for some species, birds in particular, bird feeders, bird houses can increase the ability of common species to thrive there. That's kind of a slippery slope in that you don't want to encourage competitive species, especially non-native ones like starlings and house sparrows that might have effects on the overall diversity in the region. But if you're supplementing common native birds, chickadees, some of the native woodpeckers, for example, other cavity nesters that do quite well in our settled areas. You can supplement those populations and allow them a little bit more of a buffer for the disturbance that occurs in human areas. And then for birds, there are two big things that kill birds in our settled part of the world. And the first is cats that are free roaming outside. So controlling cats, not having outside cats. If you have a cat, keep it in or provide a catio, walk it on a leash, whatever you need. Certainly the next cat you get, keep inside. I often hear people here say, "Oh, I need a barn cat." Well, nobody needs a barn cat, as far as I'm concerned, unless that barn is closed and the cat's in it all the time. That's a very irresponsible way to live on our land because those cats go out and they kill a lot of native mammals, which maybe we don't want in our area, but still they're having that effect and that decreases diversity. And they kill a lot of birds. They're the number one mortality source for birds worldwide and caused extinctions of species. So getting free roaming cats out of the landscape is a very important step. And then making windows visible to birds. Collisions with residential windows are the most important source of mortality from our built environment. And making those more visible with dots, for example, is I've got some sitting right here, feather friendly dots that are made to go on your windows, or etched windows are now becoming available for probably more commercial sorts of development for those because they're more expensive. But these dots that you can put on your window, birds see them and they avoid that window. So all of us who live where there are birds have probably heard that, crash into your window and you go out and you find a dead bird there. So identifying which windows at your house might be causing that, and then either putting shades on them or screens or these sorts of dots that birds can see can really reduce the detrimental effects of our housing, particularly on birds. So diversify your habitat, make your house safer, and keep your cats inside would be the best thing that we could all do to live better with the animals around us.
Absolutely. The core of this answer, the answer to this next question is probably pretty along similar sentiments, but you mentioned that the city center of Seattle had maybe not as low as you were expecting, but a definitely a lowered population of birds and diversity of birds compared to a suburban areas. Is there anything that you'd like to see more of on a city planning level that promotes internal in within the city avian biodiversity?
Yeah, for sure. We had an interesting program where we worked with planners and colleagues who were in urban planning as well in Seattle. And again, trying to diversify the landscape first. So having a mixture of intensely high density buildings and lower density or park spaces. I think we all appreciate parks for the values they bring us, aesthetic and psychological benefits of being able to get out and walk around in a space like that, especially if you live in a small apartment in a city. So having those green spaces around, having them include some natural habitats, not just play fields and things like that, which are important and do serve some species, but having some natural spaces as well around. And in a coastal area like Seattle, you've also got that interface of the city with the sea, or maybe it's a big lake, whatever it is, but you have that interface to also work on and have some connectivity there, have connectivity with the rivers that are flowing through, if that's a feature of a city, making the banks of those rivers, the interface with the sea more diverse, not as stark, usually like a cement wall, but instead a gradual slope of materials that go into the sea can help promote some of the marine or aquatic diversity as well. So increasing that sort of diversity and reducing the starkness of the interfaces between the different environments that naturally occur there. And then one of the, I think globally, a really important thing to do is to look at what are the native species especially I'm thinking trees in this case, which is what most of what we bring into the city in terms of habitat involves, whether it's a prairie city or a desert or whatever. We bring in trees because people like trees. And trying to keep with the native theme there. So here, for example, in the Yellowstone region, cottonwoods and willows and things like that are the native trees here. They have native flora and fauna associated with them. And keeping those as part of the cities here in the Rocky Mountain West is important because then we keep our native species also able to function in the city. In the Pacific Northwest, you wouldn't necessarily want to bring cottonwoods into all those areas, although they occur along the rivers there. But again, the main element there are the firs, Douglas fir and Western hemlock and Western red cedar. And those are the tree species we should be planting there, not so much London plane and alders and things like that, which people like to plant because they grow quickly and they produce nice shade and those sorts of things. But what that does, if we plant London planes in all the cities around the world, which is a pretty common city tree, what we end up with is basically the same habitat around the world, and the same few species that use that habitat tend to dominate all the cities around the world. So the more we can do to keep our individual cities distinct and reflecting the natural habitat that they exist in, the better we're able to keep some of our natural avifauna or mammalian species in those cities and keep the cities distinct biologically from those in Europe or Asia or wherever we may be comparing. So one of the fears is this idea of biotic homogeneity, where basically all cities, all developed areas where people live come to look the same pattern of housing or city center and suburbs around that, with the same trees and vegetation that are horticulturally promoted and put all over the place, and then the same few species of birds and animals, mammals that basically can live within those sorts of settings. So trying to reduce that homogeneity, the way our cities all look the same. You know, if you fly into a foreign country, you'd like to look down from that airplane and see something. Oh, that's different. That doesn't look like, where I just came from. And that's exciting to us, I think, when we travel, but it's also important to the native species that live there.
Sure, absolutely. I'm glad you brought up how re regional diversity and the strategies that we implement to promote biodiversity. I'm curious in terms of, now living in kind of the Bozeman area and the Gallatin area, where, sprawl, outward sprawl into the broader habitat looks different than what it looks like, I imagine, in coming out of Seattle. Is there any difference in the relationship between the impact on bird communities and land development that you've seen here versus in Seattle?
Well, I haven't surveyed along a gradient here to really have data to compare, but I did do some work on some of the ranches and farms around the area here as well. And I think the pattern could be very similar. I think the depression of avian biodiversity, anyway, in our developed areas is going to be stronger than we saw in Seattle. And I think that's for a couple of reasons. One, we're talking about grasslands, basically, or at least now manufactured grasslands that a lot of the development is going in. Not thinking about Big Sky, but thinking about the Gallatin Valley. So you have a kind of a two-dimensional landscape of grass there. And we bring in trees, we bring in houses. That could increase diversity for some species coming in there. For example, I'll use chickadees again. Coming into the trees that people have in their developments, maybe some kinglets and things like that as well, that you wouldn't get typically in the grassland. Those are forest type species. So we might increase diversity a bit with our planting there, but the development that I'm seeing here is very dense. The suburban development is very dense, and I don't see a lot of green space. Or brown space, maybe we'll say here, between those developments and certainly between the buildings in those developments. A lot of them are, multi-story apartments and condos that are going in on the fringe of Bozeman here. And I think those are going to have more of an effect like downtown city center has on biodiversity and reduce it for the most part. What we have here that's critical to diversity are riparian strings that come through the valley and the cottonwoods that grow along those. And those habitats are ones I think we need to be very focused on to keep that diversity in play. It's always been in the Rockies, that's always been the center of diversity, basically, those riparian areas, because of the aridity that is basically the defining feature of the West, and especially the Intermountain West. So having those, what we call the kind of green and blue lungs of the valley, functioning would be extremely important for diversity in the grasslands as well. And then thinking about how we might live in a grassland setting versus a forested setting in Seattle, we still want to promote diversity of grasses. And what I see when I look out over the Gallatin Valley is basically smooth brome and timothy grass. And it's not native, and it's a monoculture. Even though it might be an agricultural, important commodity, I think in the farms and ranches that I looked at here, those that graze it to varying intensity and graze it intensely for a small parcel and then move to another parcel, so promoting the diversity of height, even of grasses during the summer when birds are really utilizing those, that increases diversity of not only the plant species a bit, but also the birds that use those. So grasslands are one of the most endangered habitats in North America. And what we can do here where we live to promote native grasses, to promote diversity of grass heights, not mow them all the same, all at the same time, but be cognizant of how we manage that habitat, not just to make it neat and clean, but to make it a bit sloppy, will have a bigger effect on diversity of those grassland species that can live around us as well.
Absolutely. Thank you. I want to transition to some of the individual species that you've worked with over the course of your career. You looked a lot at corvids and starting with the pinyon jays in northern Arizona, as far as I could tell. What do you see as most fascinating about the social behaviors observed among that species?
Yeah, the pinyon jay is a very unique bird. It lives in large, permanent flocks. So, not an aggregation at a resource or not a congregation in a one season or another, but a permanent, structured flock of several hundred individuals that know each other as individuals, that communicate with each other in a very complex way, lots of different calls to mean different things. They coordinate their actions within the pair and family that make up those flocks, and they breed as a colony. They basically, their whole life revolves around one of the largest social organizations of any vertebrate that we know, permanent organization. Think about a wolf pack. Maybe it gets up to 30 or 40 animals. That's an extreme number for a wolf pack. I'm talking hundreds of individuals that live for decades, that have a strong relationship on an individual basis and as a social unit with the pinyon jay. And that's the most unique thing about it, is the size of those societies and the structure of them, the ability of them to keep a stable dominance hierarchy, to keep individual pair relationships they mate with individuals for life within that society. And that's the most unique thing. The other things they do that are fascinating, they harvest pinyon pine seeds or white bark and limber pine seeds here in the flocks that live in and around the Intermountain West. Gardner, Norris, places like that all have small flocks of pinyon jays, Cody. So those flocks basically are harvesting limber pine or ponderosa pine in some cases. Pine seeds from feeders that people provide as well. And they cache those. They use those seeds to fuel their reproduction in the summer. So they're caching in the harvesting in the fall and caching, remembering by spatial memory where they put thousands of seeds throughout the autumn so they can harvest those in the spring and winter to be able to survive during those lean parts of the year. So incredible spatial memory as well as social memory to live in these large groups. So to me, that's fascinating. The other thing that's discouraging is that although they were once a widespread and abundant species, because of our destruction of shrublands, which along with grasslands, again, are really endangered ecosystems here, their numbers have declined to the point where they've been petitioned to be listed as an endangered species, which to me as a student, 30 or 40 years ago studying these birds, I would never have guessed that this would have been an endangered species at some point. It just seemed like, it was a common bird. So they also help us remember that being common doesn't necessarily guarantee your survival and persistence. And instead, we need to make sure the habitat for them is also available.
This has been the first of a two-part episode featuring Dr. John Marsliff. In the next episode, we will discuss some of his research on the social dynamics of ravens, the behaviors of crows, and the relationship between Yellowstone's ravens and wolf reintroduction. Blah, blah, blah. This has been the first of a two-part episode featuring Dr. John Marsliff. In the next episode, we will discuss some of his research on the social dynamics of ravens, the behaviors of crows, and the relationship between Yellowstone ravens and wolf reintroduction. We will also discuss John's plans as one of the newest board members of the Gallatin Wildlife Association. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. More information about the association and its activities can be found on its website, www.gallatinwildlife.org. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell.